Good evening and welcome to the third presentation in this our 12th series of talks on faraway places with strange sounding names. My name is Brian Kutz, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with my colleague in the blue back there, Peggy Wright, and with assistance from our webmaster here taking pictures, Hai Wong Wong, and our reference coordinator, Brian Carson. Daniel Peach and Christopher McConnell designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Daniel Pauly. Our speaker tonight is WKU's most traveled faculty member, and since January, he's been in Lima, Easter Island, Chile, Samoa, Port Douglas, Australia, Cambodia, Jaipur, India, Tanzania, Jordan, Maui, Buenos Aires, Shrewsbury, England, with trips to New Zealand, Australia. Just returned, he tells us, from those two, and yet to go to the Virgin Islands. By year's end, he will have traveled 3,276,965 miles. It's tiring just to list it. A native of Shrewsbury, England, he later moved to Australia in the 1970s, and from 1973 until 1987, he was an international tax consultant before settling in New Orleans as vice president and CFO of Signal Communications. An academic career beckoned, and he enrolled in the University of Oregon, where he received his PhD in geography and joined the Geography and Geology Department at WKU in 1993, becoming department head in 2001. His research interests are broad in nature and global in outlook, from books on Argentina and Buenos Aires to articles on Colombia, Mexico, and even world cities. His most recent publications include an article, Cityscapes and Footprints, Dancing Through the Urban, for Geographical Review, Transportation Geography, Local Challenges, Global Context, for Progress in Human Geography, and a revision of his articles on Buenos Aires for the Encyclopedia Britannica. As a member of the American Geographical Society's writing circle, his op-ed pieces have appeared in newspapers from San Francisco to Anchorage. He first visited Gabon as a backpacker in the 1970s and returned there most recently in 2009 on an American Geographical Society education expedition. Please give a warm welcome to David Keeling. David.
Thank you, Brian. I think Brian's talking about my evil twin because I'm just a country boy from Tennessee. So. Gabon. How many have heard of Gabon before? A couple of you have heard about Gabon. I mean, this really meets the goal of this particular series, faraway places with strange sounding names. It really is far away. It's one of those parts of Africa that not a lot of Westerners get to. It really is, in many ways, Africa's last Eden. And I'll explain where that term comes from. Some of you may have heard of Mike Fay and Mike Nichols, who did a transect through the equatorial part of Africa a few years ago. And it really is a most spectacular place with incredible landscapes, amazing people, and a history and geography that suggests some real challenges for the country and for the region ahead, but also hold out some real promise for some possible change for Africa in the next 10, 15, 20 years. I'm a little jet lagged, so if I sort of stumble and fall, you'll be okay. But, you know, 20,000 miles in a week is sort of hard on the body. One of the highlights of Gabon are the surfing hippos of Luango National Park, and I'll talk about that in a little while. So where in the world are we? Right, those of you that are geophiles or who know a little bit about geography will recognize the equator, and Gabon sits right on the equator in the central part of Africa, just under the bulge on the coast of the eastern part of the South Atlantic Ocean. It is a country that is divided into these provinces. It's sort of a quasi-federal system, but political and social and economic power is really concentrated in the capital city, Libreville, basically free city, much like Freetown in other parts of Africa. And it is a country that in many ways is representative of Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, and the challenges that this region faces. But in many ways, it is not representative of Africa at all. It is a country that is doing some very, very different things in very many different ways. So how did I get to Gabon? Brian mentioned that I sort of traipsed around Africa a little bit in the 1970s, get into trouble, as young people tend to do back in those days. But most recently, I was on this particular trip with the American Geographical Society, this Casablanca of the Cape, which was an expedition, an educational expedition with 80 people, basically running down the entire western side of Africa from Casablanca, Morocco, to Cape Town, South Africa, understanding modern Africa and thinking about the challenges for this region economically, politically, and socially. And so we got to sample a number of different cultures in this area: Cameroon, Central African Republic, Namibia, Gabon, of course, and places like Chad and Niger and Burkina Faso and Mali, just to name a few of them. So that was a sort of a long but interesting trip. It's always good to sort of think about where these places are in comparison to our own milieu, our own environment. And here's a map of Kentucky overlaid on a map of Gabon to give you a sense of size and scale. About 103,000 square miles in Gabon, and Kentucky 40,000 or so square miles. So, you know, it gives you an idea of what these countries look like. About 2.5 times the size of Kentucky. Africa, as you know, is a very, very complex region socially, ethnically, culturally. Many of the peoples that moved into this area, that is today Gabon, in the 11th and 12th century, come generally from the Bantu tribes that came out of the Niger River area, places that we know today as Nigeria, Mali, those regions in the western bulge of Africa. And if you think about Africa, it's probably one of the most ethnically, culturally complex regions in the world in terms of the complexity of ethno-linguistic identities within a country. It's one of the challenges that African countries have faced in a political sense since independence, most of them gaining independence in the 60s and 70s, in trying to foster, and develop a sense of a national identity. How do you make a Gabonese, politically, economically, socially, out of these individual identities? The Bakunu, the Shake, the Fang, the Ayumba, all of these different groups that have very, very different ethno-linguistic identities that are part of this nation, this political state called Gabon, but come from very, very different backgrounds. And in many cases, these people don't understand these people if they were talking their native languages. Right, so they have to use a lingua franca, a national language, to communicate at that level. That's one of the challenges that African countries particularly have faced in the 20th century, into the 21st century, as this new political system that was created out of the colonial system puts all these people together and tries to figure out how to create a national political identity. A Nigerian, a Gabonese, a Malian, a Tanzanian, creating that identity out of this mix of people. So French is the lingua franca, because this was a French colony in the late 19th, early 20th century. English is widely spoken, obviously. It is the language of international tourism and business. So if you're wandering around in some of these off-the-beaten-track places, you'll likely do fine if you speak a little French, likely won't do fine if you speak a little English if you're off-the-beaten-track, because you're off the beaten track. Nobody's speaking English in these faraway places. But if you go to the major city, Libreville, Port-Gentil, or go down to the national parks, Vivenu, or Luango, English is widely spoken because most of the visitors to those destinations are European or North American. And so English is the language for tourism. But French is widely spoken in government and is the major unifying language in the schools. So they'll learn native languages in their village or their home. They'll learn French in school along with English, particularly these days. And as you can see from this map, in terms of linguistic complexity, there are lots and lots of what we call micro-dialects, where a very small number of people will speak a particular dialect that might be unintelligible to the group 50 miles away or 100 miles away or over the hill, right? Because these groups grew up very much in isolation until you started to get some measure of interaction with trade and commerce later on during the pre-colonial period. So if you think about the opening up of Africa, the early voyages of exploration starting in the middle 15th century with the Portuguese primarily, who came down the west coast of Africa, starting from Lisbon, coming down through the islands, the Canary Islands, the Cape Verde Islands, down the coast, setting up little trading ports along the coast of Africa. If you go back and look at a colonial map of 17th century Africa, you'll see all of these Portuguese trading ports along the coast. But this region of Africa remained fairly isolated from those main European trade routes, in part because the Europeans didn't venture too far inland. Right? Not a very good idea to go into an interior of a country that you don't know much about, you don't have protections against things like diseases, malaria, etc., and hostile native peoples. Right? Because the slave trade particularly was well into its boom period in the 17th and early 18th century. Slaving was not necessarily just a European process. There were lots and lots of indigenous peoples that were capturing rival groups or rival communities and selling them. So it was a pretty dangerous place to travel. And it remains dangerous to this day in some parts of Gabon, I can tell you. And so much of the interior of Gabon, well into the late 20th century, really remained off the beaten track, really were faraway places in terms of our knowledge of this area. And one of the most interesting explorations that happened was fairly recently with this National Geographic expedition, the great mega transect of this equatorial part of Africa, which really revealed a lot of scientific knowledge and broader cultural understanding of this region that even to this day remains fairly unknown to most people. So think about how Africa was transformed from this pre-colonial period, these little isolated settlements along the coast, east and west, along the Mediterranean, obviously, and how this area came to take its form with boundaries that were created by Europeans, not by Africans. These boundaries were set in place primarily after the 1884 Conference of Berlin. This is when many of these European powers, led by Germany, France, England, got together. Everybody got a little red pen and a little ruler. They sat around a table and they said, okay, I'll give you this bit and you can have that bit. And if you look at the map, it's like, how did that happen? It's like the little finger. It's like, what went on there? You know, some really interesting negotiations, some trading that went on in terms of access, who gets to get near the river, who has the coast. And so the lines that you see on the map are incredibly artificial. Right? They don't make a lot of sense in terms of cultural or even physical boundaries. Right? These are lines that were created by colonial powers for their own evil ends in the 19th century. Right? And of course, the Africans weren't invited to the Conference of Berlin. You know, they woke up in the morning and said, oh, now we're part of the German Empire. Oh, now we're part of the French Empire. May we? You know, and you know, all of a sudden, their life begins to change as the Europeans come in. So this part of Africa particularly underwent quite a few changes between 1884 and the 1920s and 1930s. This green area here eventually became what was known as French Equatorial Africa. Right? France had significant holdings in this western part of Africa, places like Mali, for example, and Burkina Faso and Chad. But it also had this strip, French Equatorial Africa, that came down as far as Gabon. And that's one of the reasons why French is the dominant language of this country today. August 17th, 1960, a very important day for Gabonese. This is their national independence day. It's our July 4th, right? Independence from France, and fairly shortly afterwards, join the United Nations, which brings them into the group of political entities that share many of the same goals and aspirations, particularly as a new country in Africa in the 1960s. Again, highlighting really the only two major cities in Gabon, Libreville and Port-Gentil. Population today is around about 1.5 million, and is not an overly populated country, just a little bigger than the size of Nashville, right? So, it's quite different from a neighbor just up the road, Nigeria, where you have 100+ million people, where you have, you know, pretty sizable cities like Lagos and Abuja and Kano and other places. This is a fairly low-key place. And when you go to the big city of Libreville, for example, it's really got a Bowling Green small town atmosphere. Right? It has a Kentucky Fried Chicken in Libreville, you know, which is sad but true. You know, that's sort of what happens. Thinking about its situation in sub-Saharan Africa, it actually has a economic status is quite different from most of its neighbors. It's the fourth highest ranking on the Human Development Index in the region, right? 93rd in the world rankings, which is not that great, but in the region, it has a pretty high status in terms of Human Development Index. The HDI measures a lot of things like access to drinking water, accommodations, health care, those types of things, right? In terms of the human capacity in the area. And it has the third highest GDP in the region. Purchasing power parity is an economic technique that looks at the GDP productivity of a country, measured it against a basket of currencies, typically the US dollar, the euro, the yen, those types of things, and matches how much that peso or dollar will buy. And so by African standards, this is pretty good, 14,600. If you think about that, think about our neighbor to the south, Mexico. Anybody, any idea what its PPP GDP is? It's a lot lower than Gabon, that's for sure. And Mexico is a country with 105 million people. And Mexico's about 4,250, something like that. Right? If you were to go just across the jungle a little bit to the Central African Republic, which is one of the economic basket cases of sub-Saharan Africa, it has a PPP of somewhere around about $700. Right? So by comparison, Gabon is in pretty good shape in terms of its gross domestic product purchasing power parity. Now, why is that? What is Gabon doing, or what does it have, that gives it this economic advantage? I'll tell you. Somebody's spoiling the story there. If you look at the economy and think about how it's structured, yes, it has oil. Right? That's where the money's come from. About 75% of its exports are in crude oil. And it's high-grade crude as well, so it fetches a good price. I think oil hit over $100 a barrel again today. So it's got pretty good income from oil. Timber, manganese, and uranium are the other raw materials making up 25% of the economy. So if you think about that, it's a raw material export-based economy. Right? Gabon doesn't make a lot of stuff. It doesn't add value to the raw materials, which presents challenges, of course. Export partners, Russia, 35%, U.S., and China, and then the rest made up of France and a whole bunch of other countries. Most of the imports come from France, like 35%, and then scattered around the rest of the countries. Why France? Obviously, the colonial relationship, right? There's that predilection for French products. A good croissant in the morning is very important. A nice glass of Burgundy is important. It's the overlay of that French cultural influence from the colonial period that's still very important. And of course, a lot of the Gabonese political elite, educated people, have received their training in France or the United States or other parts. So definitely one of the highest economies in sub-Saharan Africa. But that masks a problem that is ubiquitous for sub-Saharan Africa, whether you are in South Africa, which is sub-Saharan Africa's biggest economy, most prosperous economy, or in the Central African Republic. And that's the distribution of income, the inequality in the distribution of income. As in a lot of these countries, here in Gabon, the richest 20% get almost all the income. Right? The economic elite, the political elite, get almost all of the income. About a third of all Gabonese live in pretty bad poverty. And this is not the sort of poverty that we might be familiar with here in the United States, in the ghettos of Chicago or Los Angeles, or the rural communities of impoverished Appalachia. This is a poverty that is life-sapping and bone-crushing. Right? You really don't understand poverty until you go to a Brazilian favela or a Mexican shantytown or a Gabonese shantytown. It's a very, very different quality of life, very different challenges for the human condition. And so this is one of the big political and social challenges for Gabon, just like many other countries in the region. Gabon has the money, theoretically, to address these challenges, but the political will, the infrastructure to trickle down, if you will, or to build these social programs, doesn't seem to be working as well as it could. Gabonese people understand this, the political representatives understand this, but as we well know, even in our own society, there's a big difference between understanding the problem and actually fixing the problem. And in Gabon, it continues to be a challenge. So Gabon, like many countries in Africa, is fairly well endowed with resources. There is oil, gold, cocoa, peanuts, coffee, sisal, diamonds, all over the place. Here's Gabon, oil being the major resource. But you can see just from these two major areas, West Africa and Central Africa, there's lots and lots of resources here that the global economy needs. Like many places in the world, where you're thinking about Latin America, or you're thinking about sub-Saharan Africa, or Siberia, just having raw materials alone as a measure of wealth is not sufficient to build a socially balanced society. You know, there are other things that you need. You need infrastructure. You need educational opportunities. You need a government system that is not corrupt, that prepares society for opportunities, that helps to create opportunities. And those are some of the challenges that countries throughout the region have. Even South Africa, which is the most economically developed country in the region, continues to face some real challenges in creating those economic and social opportunities. So one of the defining features of this region, this equatorial region, is the rainforest. And you know, some of you may have images of rainforest in your head. It's not the Tarzan stuff, you know, we're on the rope and sort of swinging through the trees and stuff. It's a very, very different type of environment. And you really can't understand rainforest until you're standing in it and you're breathing it and you're thinking about it. It's hot, it's oppressive, it's alive, it's an incredibly biodiverse environment, it's fascinating. Anybody seen that film with Sean Connery, Medicine Man? Remember that? And they're there, and they say, "Oh, the cure for cancer and everything is here in the jungle. We cut down all the trees; all the cures are gone." Well, there's some truth to that. You know, there's an incredible amount of diversity in these equatorial rainforests that we only understand the barest, smallest percentage of. Because we really haven't explored these places enough to understand how things work. Right? So, you know, this tropical rainforest extends all the way through this equatorial area, and you can get up to 17 feet of rainfall. And, you know, you think about that in terms of inches, you know, that's over 200 of inches of rainfall a year. What do we get here, about 48, 50 inches? And if you've ever stood in equatorial rain where it's raining a foot an hour, right, it's coming down, it hurts your head, right? If you have an umbrella, it'll break it. It's that hot. That's why all the monkeys are running for cover. I mean, it's really, really hard, heavy rain. Tremendous amount of water flow in this area. So because of that, you've got this ecological environment that is turning itself over at an incredibly rapid rate, right? Very rapid decomposition. And if you think about traditional rainforests, whether it's the Amazon rainforest or the African rainforest, all of the material, the nutrients are up in the canopy, right? All the biomass is up in the canopy. It's not down on the ground. Well, you're not having to hack through the stuff on the ground. That's basically the dead and dying material and the occasional Gabonese viper, which you have to look out for. It's all up in the canopy, and it's the canopy that receives all the rainfall, and that's where the biomass is located. So you can imagine that these equatorial soils here in this region are fairly poor. They're thin, they're leached. When you cut down the trees, when you log for export, what happens to the soil? If you've got 17 feet of rain a year falling on very thin, leached soil, it doesn't take long to turn this into an unproductive desert in terms of what happens to the soils.
Does it have a rainy season, or is it consistently the same?
Yeah, it's wet and very wet. Yeah, it's a pulse. So you get what's officially called the dry season, where it's not so wet, and then you get the really wet season. And it's driven, of course, by the movement of the sun relative to the earth between the tropics. So you get this phase between the sort of the solstices where it eases up a little bit. It's the dry season, and that's true of the Amazon area, and it's true of this area as well. You get distinct seasons in the rainforest that are dry. You still get a little bit of rain every day, but it's not coming down at a serious pace. So 37 countries make up this rainforest area, and about 15% of the land surface of Africa. And of course, Gabon is right in the heart of this, right? Now, you'd think that all this rain, there'd be some big river systems in Gabon, particularly, but there aren't. There are no major river systems. So this is up near Ivanhoe National Park in the middle of the country. This is sort of a typical rainforest environment, right? And there's a couple of places where you can get up into the canopy and you can actually walk from one part of the forest to another on a little forest walk. It's not very well developed yet. The tourist industry is just starting to develop some infrastructure. But, you know, there's a real concern here to be as ecologically sensitive as possible. You don't want to build Disney World in a rainforest, right? Because, you know, that's not good. But as you can see, it's a very lush and intriguing place. Now, as I mentioned about these river basins, here's Gabon, and it has no countrywide river basin, right? There are all these little streams that drain out of the highlands down to the coast, but the major river basin for this central rainforest here is right here, the Congo River Basin, which really doesn't drain at all from Gabon, right? So it's really a country that doesn't have a major waterway at all. It's just a series of small streams that just drain down to the coast and form a set of lagoons down along the coastal area. As I said, two big cities, Libreville and Port-Gentil, 600,000 Libreville. So this is not a very, very big city. And then lots and lots of little villages all around the country, most of them 10,000, 15,000, 20,000. So I was up in this area here, and then down here around the lagoons, this is Luanga National Park, which I'll show you a little bit in a minute, this area. This is a flying into the airport in Port-Gentil. It's a fairly unspectacular urban environment. It's fairly industrial. It's mostly driven by the oil economy, so a lot of the oil rigs are here to get processed. There's a major port here for oil tankers coming in and out. Not a lot of nightlife, no Starbucks, but there is a McDonald's and a couple of reasonably nice hotels. It's not a pretty place to visit. Right? There are other more interesting places, certainly, in this country. This is an article that was in the New York Times a little while ago talking about some of the environmental pressures. And it's one of the things that National Geographic photographer and naturalist Mike Fay and Mike Nichols talked about when they did their African transect a few years ago, that Central Africa, particularly this sort of equatorial rainforest area, is incredibly vulnerable to environmental devastation, whether it's cutting down the trees or mining or setting up Disney World in the forest, whatever it might be. The big issue here is that the Chinese have been very active in sub-Saharan Africa. The Chinese are investing a lot in resource development. They're helping to develop a lot of transportation routes. They're looking to secure resources for their own economy, which makes sense in an economic environment. And one of the things that is needed in Gabon is more electrical capacity to drive industrialization. And in order to do that, one of the solutions is to build a hydroelectric dam. You've got lots of water coming off the highlands down through these streams. And so the Chinese have a proposal to build a big hydroelectric facility up here in the Ivindo River near one of what I think is one of the world's most spectacular areas, waterfall natural environment, the Congo Falls here in the Ivindo National Park. It's a beautiful place. It's unspoiled. Very, very few tourists go there. It really is off the beaten track. It is a faraway place, even from Libreville or from Port Gentil. These plans to construct this hydroelectric dam really are raising a lot of concerns within Gabon and internationally about development strategies. Right? There's no doubt that Gabon needs hydroelectricity. It could help propel the economy forward, but there are lots of other places to build it outside this national park. And so there's a real struggle going on. It's slowed down the process of getting the dam built, so ground hasn't been broken yet. There's been surveys. If you go and look at Google Earth and zoom in with the satellite, you can see these big, long, red gashes through the rainforest where these contractors have gone in with the bulldozers and just bulldoze a straight line to go in and do the survey. And so either way you look at these types of projects, there's disruption to the environment's going to happen. This is probably one of the most magnificent natural areas in the African equatorial region, and to see it damaged by hydroelectric facility or anything else would be a shame, particularly when there are other areas to develop. From a tourist perspective, the Gabonese are thinking seriously about ecotourism as the money generator for the 21st century. It's an expensive place to get to. The resources are fairly basic still in terms of accommodating package tourism, so you're not going to see a lot of Thomas Cook tours go to Gabon. It's mostly the type of tours that I've been on and backpackers. So they're really looking at ecotourism in part because all the research shows that ecotourism generally returns a much higher level of profit than mainstream or mass tourism, and theoretically is a little less harsh on the environment. There's sort of more of a consciousness about the environment with ecotourism. And you know, this is a poster that I saw about the origin of marine debris from the coastal Atlantic in the National Park of Luango. It's amazing. You walk along the beach and it's amazing the stuff that's on the beach, you know. It's just, where does this stuff come from? Well, some of it is local, some of it is carried on the currents from afar, but there's an amazing amount of trash that turns up on this incredibly pristine beach in Luango, where maybe 50,000 people a year might go, if that. Right? So, you know, it's a real challenge to maintain those issues. This is really hard duty. I mean, going to places like this and you know, it's really, really hard work. You know, sitting in the little outdoor area, watching the sun go down, drinking your favorite beverage, watching the hippos. You know, it's tough, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And this is probably, well, it's definitely the crown jewel of Gabon in terms of the national park. I would rate it probably as the second or third ranked national park in sub-Saharan Africa. You know, there are a number that might vie for number one. I think the Serengeti in Tanzania, the Masai Mara, is probably up there as the most spectacular place. Certainly places like Kruger National Park in South Africa, the Okavango Delta, Botswana, but this is up there. I'd rank this as you know, a close second or third. It is spectacular, and the nice thing is that nobody goes there. Right? That's why it's really, really expensive, right? But nobody goes there. Right? So it really is a little oasis. And you know, one of the things you can do is you can drift along. We went down several of these little rivers, and you drift along, and you just sort of, you know, you look at the ecosystem, you think about what's there. And these are the two people that really focused attention on this part of the world a few years ago. Mike Fay and Mike Nichols did this transect, and they called this Africa's Last Eden. Right? They did this transect all the way through the equatorial rainforest, ended up right here on the beach in Loango National Park, where the hippos surf, and they described the ecology and environment of this transect and marveled at the incredible diversity and complexity of this region that we know nothing about from a scientific perspective, almost nothing about at all. And, you know, just thinking about the complexity of this environment and the species and the plants and animals, the insects, things that bite in this area, and, you know, it's just really an amazing landscape. So they did this transect from the Central African Republic, you know, all the way down to the coast and analyzed and mapped this stuff. And if you've not read this in Nat Geo, 2001 it came out, go check this out and read this. It's really a fascinating story about this journey, several year journey, mapping, analyzing, photographing, really this last almost pristine spot on this planet. Right? There are very few places on this earth that are really untouched by the human hand, by human economies. And this is one of those places that is still relatively untouched. It is the crown jewel of Gabon. Now, there are always interesting decisions and choices that governments and societies have to make when they think about development, right? Because there's a real practical difference between growth and development. And it's one of the things that I preach to students all the time is that you hear those two words sort of conflated a lot. You know, growth and development are sort of, you know, interchangeable. They sort of mean the same thing. Well, they don't, right? Growth is, in a sense, the things that you can measure or count. Did the GDP go up? Have you got more people? Did you build more roads? Have you got more educational facilities? Have you got a higher quality of life? Do you live longer? That's growth, right? Because you can measure that stuff and you can follow a trajectory, up or down, flat, whatever. Right? But growth doesn't mean development. Right? Development is about the human condition. Development is about, are you better off? Are you healthy? Are you better educated? Right? Are you more productive? Do you have more economic or political freedoms? Right? So one of the real challenges for Gabon and for countries in sub-Saharan Africa is trying to figure out this difference and competition almost between growth and development. Because everybody gets dazzled by growth. Right? Oh, we can put up more buildings and put people's names on them. We can have all sorts of new transportation infrastructure. We can have bigger airplanes and better roads and all those types of things, all of which is good stuff, and it helps to develop a society and move a society along. But does that lead to development? Does that improve the quality of life of the people? Does that improve the capacity, the productivity? And there's a lot of evidence, particularly in Latin America, where I do a lot of research, but particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, that there's a real disconnect between growth and development. We've got a lot of growth going on, but we haven't really solved the problem of development. Here's a country with almost $15,000 per capita GDP, and you still have 600,000 people, over half of the country's population, living in conditions of abject poverty. Right? It's unacceptable for a country the size of Gabon with only 1.5 million people, with all of that oil revenue and $15,000 per capita. That's unacceptable. Right? So you look at Gabon since the 1960s, spectacular growth. Growth in all quarters. More roads, more houses, more railroads, more hydroelectricity, more of everything, more tourists, more McDonald's hamburgers, more of this stuff. Right? But have we seen development at the same level? And the answer is no. And that's one of the real challenges for sub-Saharan Africa and for countries like Gabon. I love this picture. It's like, you go to Gabon, it doesn't matter if you have to stay up all night. I think it was something like 3 a.m. before we got there, Bo. You know? I mean, you have to really camp and wait and then take along a few beverages and, you know, just hang out, have a party, and, you know, wait for the hippo to come out. It's really an amazing sight because the hippos, you know, you ever seen a real hippo even at a zoo? I mean, these are big animals, right? And they sort of waddle out through the sand and they waddle into the surf and they swim out there and the little ones are swimming along and then, you know, they get up to these big cresting Atlantic waves and they turn around and it's like, whee! He comes surfing in, it's like, it blows your mind. This is amazing, right? And you can tell they're hanging 5 or 6 or 5, 4 or whatever they got. They're hanging it and they're having a really good time. And I think it's one of the things that Mike Fay and Mike Nichols, when they were doing this transect, you know, when they got to the end of their journey to Luango and they camped on the beach and they saw the hippos and they saw the surfing, they're like, wow. You know, this planet that we live on is just an amazing place. There are so many things that you just don't expect to see. Surfing hippo. I've never seen a surfing hippo in my life before. I will die a happy geographer because I've seen a surfing hippo. That's pretty amazing. You have to be really careful. This is a Nat Geo photo from Mike Nichols. There's a Gabon viper here. Right? See? And, you know, you're just sort of traipsing through the jungle. You know. You got to be really careful here. So happy to take some questions about Gabon or the journey or whatever's there. Yeah, can you see it? It's incredibly well camouflaged, right?
That's his head right there that looks like a leaf.
Yeah.
Oh.
And they are nasty, nasty little things. I mean, they will kill a grown human. Right? So, you know, you have to be super, super careful about where you step. Marvin, how you doing? You've been out in Santa Barbara. Far away places.
Questions? Back here.
How do people really earn a living? Not just the oil industry, but those who are at the lower end of society. What do they do to survive? And what is the education opportunity? What are the educational opportunities?
Education is mandatory up till 12 years old, like 7th grade, something like that. But just because it's mandatory doesn't mean that kids go to class. I mean, you have, if you're out in a rural environment where you're growing crops for subsistence during the harvest season, you're not in school, you're out working the field. So, you know, the percentage of students that actually receive what we would consider to be a full-term education is fairly low. Typically, you only find that in the elite populations or the urban middle class that will send their kids to a high school or send them off to France to university, typically. The majority of the lower sector of society, we're talking about 60 to 70% or so, are involved either in agriculture or in the informal economy. So if you were to go into a community like Port Gentil or Libreville, you'll find, you know, lots of things out on the streets, sort of open-air markets, you know, people who will cut your hair, they've got a little stand on the street, they'll cut your hair or do your nails or fix your bike or put a new carburetor in your car, whatever it might be, do construction. Right? So there's a lot of informal work in the economy. And that's part of the black economy that isn't taxed, that isn't really understood too well by the government, but it employs the majority of the population. A lot of people have seasonal jobs. They may work, for example, in a sisal area or growing peanuts or whatever it might be, and then they'll go work on an oil rig for 3 months or work in the tourist industry during the season as a driver or a guide or a cook. Most of the people that were working in Luango, and they had a staff of about, I think about 35 or 40 people, most of them were seasonal workers because there's about 4 months of the year where nobody goes to Luango because you're getting 17 feet of rain. Right? So people go back to their village and do agriculture or other things. So that's one of the big challenges for Gabon and for other countries where you have a huge informal economy. What do you do to get skills to the people, improve their education level, and bring them into a formal economy where you can improve the level of productivity? Whether it's manufacturing or adding value to a raw material, instead of shipping raw peanuts out, make peanut butter, make peanut bread. Add some value to the raw material. So you tend to see a lot of people just hanging out. Hanging out. Margaret, sorry.
Another question.
Yeah.
Were you there with the American Geographical?
Yeah, American Geographical Society.
Why was that particular country that was selected? I'm trying to avoid this horrible camera.
It was the way the itinerary was designed for maximum excitement. Right, and the idea was to go really off the beaten track. Right, as an example, the country we visited before that was Cameroon, and we flew into this small town called Fumbon, and they had a military airport there, but they had never had a passenger plane land at Fumbon, so they had no steps that they could bring up to the plane. We had a 757, right? So they had no steps. So 2 days before we arrived, they had a team of carpenters working day and night to make a set of steps for the plane, right? And so we landed, and they said, slow taxi, steps not ready yet. So slow taxi, turn the plane around. And these two guys come running up with this brand newly created set of wooden steps, and perfectly, just pushed it right up to the plane, perfect fit. Because right? They had the height, they had the width and the thing. And, you know, they were incredibly proud of their work. But, you know, this is a place that had never seen tourists really before. That was so we try and pick places that really are far away and off the beaten track, because it really gives you an insight into a society that most people just don't get. Fun places to go.
Can I assume that Walmart has not yet founded?
You can assume correctly, but not for long. In fact, the French chain, you remember what the French chain is?
Carrefour,
that's right. Carrefour just opened a store in Libreville a few years ago, and is now, I think they're going to open one in Port-Gentil pretty soon, and before long they'll be all open. Brian?
I'm wondering what puts it so high on the Human Development Index. Because actually, even saying it's 93rd in the world, when you figure there's, 1,290, something like that, countries, puts it in the upper half. What puts it so high on the Human Development Index? Is it healthcare? Is it education? Is it what is actually putting it high?
Well, the Human Development Index is a measure of a basket of processes in society: education, health, you know, the openness of the government, access to basic resources, employment opportunities, those types of things. So if you look at that basket of social structures, Gabon is better off than a lot of its neighbors. 93rd in the country, obviously it is in the top half, but there's 92 countries ahead of it in development. But compared to places like Rwanda or Central African Republic or Chad, you know, where there are a multiplicity of social problems, Gabon is stable. There's a fair amount of political freedom. There's a pretty good education system there. It's based on the French Lycée system. You do have pretty good healthcare systems in the main towns, and also access to some measure of healthcare in the villages. Right, so you add all those things together, and you do the little statistical dance that the United Nations does, and it's pretty robust for sub-Saharan Africa. And part of it is it's got oil. Oil generates revenue, builds the GDP, gives you the flexibility to do things.
You visit all the states in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Which one was your most favorite?
Kentucky, of course. Now, you know, that's an interesting question, because people always say, well, what's the favorite country you visited? And I always say, the one I was just in, right? Because as a geographer, we always see something special and distinctive and different about every landscape that we go to. So you could go to Italy 100 times and never see the same thing. Right? Going to Gabon has just scratched the surface. There are 100 places to see in Gabon that are profoundly different from the last place. Right? So, you know, the idea of just going to a destination and saying, well, you know, tick off, I've done Burma, you know, that's Rangoon, that's Burma. Right? It's just one tiny part of a much more complex system. So, you know, I'm fairly well traveled, but I know nothing about these countries, compared to somebody who lives there or studies them all their life or whatever. We're just transient geographers moving through these landscapes and trying to glean a little bit of knowledge about how these people live their lives. That's the beauty of travel as an educative process, right? Is that you see, you learn, you understand, you analyze, you talk. Right? It's fun. Do it. Go overseas right now, get on a study abroad program this summer. Right?
We have a question back here. Yeah.
On those trips, it's usually about 80. 80. Usually about 80.
Lots of smaller.
Yeah, other times there's more. If it's a study abroad program, we usually have, you know, 10 to 15. We've done, Dad, how many? We've done as many as, what, 26, 27 in Australia? Yeah. We like fairly small groups because you can work them harder.
All of the flooding, how are roads maintained, and how do people really get around?
They have a big bobcat, right? Well, I mean, because almost all of the roads in Gabon outside the main cities are dirt roads, and so in the wet season, unless you've got a tank, you're not going anywhere, right? Even a nice big four-wheel drive Land Rover. So people just stay put for a while when it's really bad. Then the big grader comes along and bulldozes everything out of the way, you know, because the trees are falling down and there's big potholes and stuff. And, you know, to do a 30-mile trip in the interior will take you about 9 to 10 hours. I mean, and that's another one of the challenges for a developing economy, is that they don't have 6-lane I-65s like we do. Right? To get anywhere can take a significant amount of time. Right? So to get from Libreville into Evinu National Park, the last stage of that almost took us 10 hours to do about 35 miles. You know, it's remote. Brian, you had a follow-up?
Yes, so you said that out in the villages there's some measure of health care, there's some measure of educational system. So talk about the inequality socially and income-wise, but is the government investing some money then in these kinds of services?
Yeah, there is a national development program that targets primarily education and health, right? And They're reasonably well funded. They have money from the European Union, they have money from the UN and a number of other areas, but you know, the scale of the problem is pretty enormous. Even for a small country like Gabon with only 1.5 million people, when you've got literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of small villages where populations are, you know, a couple of hundred to a couple of thousand scattered all over the country, you know, there's a scale and management problem. So compared to a country like Central African Republic or Rwanda or other parts, Chad, for example, Gabon has done a much, much better job of bringing these services to rural communities. But It's not ubiquitous. It's not everywhere. Not every village or town has access to a high level of service. Right? So that's the development part, is that development always lags behind growth. And, you know, it's operationalizing the problem that takes a long time.
What's the average life expectancy?
That's a good question. It's somewhere around 45 to 48 on average in some of the poorer parts of the area. In some of the better endowed cities and bigger towns, it's getting up to Western standards, 60s, high 50s, low 60s. Malaria, HIV, AIDS particularly, is taking a deadly toll on the region. And so you're seeing a whole generation of 10-year-olds to 25-year-olds where mortality rate is incredibly high. And it's, you know, it's a real challenge to address those issues. HIV, AIDS particularly, continues to devastate much of sub-Saharan Africa. So it's a real challenge. Young man in the back there, you had a follow-up question?
One more question?
That's the dilemma, because the growth part of the equation is important. Gabon needs hydroelectricity. It has a natural resource that it can turn into hydroelectricity that will move the economy forward industrially. Right? So there's no debate about the need for the infrastructure. The development part of the equation is that there are lots of choices of where to put the dam. And it doesn't necessarily mean that location A is the best place environmentally or the best place economically. So that's the dilemma, is that if you find the best location from an engineering standpoint, that might be the best location from an engineering standpoint to build a dam, but is it the best for the environment, for the ecology? Are there other options that might cost a little more? Those are the dilemmas that you've got to figure out. And, I'm not an environmental engineering expert, so I don't know exactly what the issues are, but you saw the picture of the Canoe Falls there. If that flow changes so that the physical fall properties disappear and you lose that beautiful landscape, right, is that worth the building of a hydroelectric facility? Again, it's a development question. It's a question of balance, as the Moody Blues said in the 1990s.
Thank you. Thanks for coming, everybody.
Yeah. On behalf of our sponsor, WKU Libraries, friends of Kentucky Library and KU Libraries and Kentucky Museum, our host here at Barnes & Noble, hope you'll join us again in February when we'll again be taking another look at a faraway place. Thanks and good evening.